Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour, NPR's roundtable podcast about what we are watching, reading, and listening to. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. On this week's show, we check in with the new film, Steve Jobs, which examines the legacy of the Apple legend. The writing, the performances, the beard on Seth Rogen, we'll get to all of it. In our second segment, we'll broaden out and talk about mogul movies generally. The great titans of business and commerce are often a fascination of storytellers, but do they fascinate audiences? And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week, so don't go away.
Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Car advice, tips, troubleshooting, and occasional answers to car questions in between the laughter. That's the Car Talk Podcast with Click and Clack, the Tappet Brothers. Laugh along anytime to the Car Talk Podcast. Find Car Talk now at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.
Captains of industry are at the forefront this week, but before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
And with us this week is our pal Gene Demby. Gene Demby, what do you do at NPR?
I'm a blogger at NPR's Code Switch.
So we're starting off this week with Steve Jobs. Now, Steve Jobs is not the first film about the Apple co-founder, but it may be the one with the strongest pedigree. It's directed by Danny Boyle, who directed Slumdog Millionaire and 127 Hours. And the screenplay is adapted from Walter Isaacson's book by Aaron Sorkin of The West Wing, The American President, Moneyball, Sports Night, and maybe most importantly, The Social Network. Mm-hmm. It's set at a series of product launches divided roughly into thirds. The first third is at the launch of the first Macintosh in 1984. Then in 1988, the launch of the Next Cube, which you may not remember was
swept
a thing,
the nation.
But it was. And then in 1998, at the launch of the iMac. And at all of these product launches, he's interacting with a variety of different people. Kate Winslet playing a woman who works for him in marketing. Seth Rogen playing Steve Wozniak, who had worked with him on the original, who was kind of there at the beginning of Apple, and they were kind of in and out. And he's in and out of Apple over the course of this movie.
Right.
At the middle product launch, he's kind of in exile following the fate of the first Macintosh. So you get these essentially three acts. It's very Sorkinian in that way. Glenn, what did you think of this movie?
I liked it. Didn't love it. That structure is very much the structure of a play. Mm-hmm. The format of it, it's, we spend a lot of time in very tight close-up and two shots, which is the format of television. Mm-hmm. So I think it felt smaller than I thought this was going to feel. But it's really smart to have it structured around those product launches, because if you're not an Apple fanboy or fangirl, the public face of Steve Jobs, who you think of, is that guy
right.
up there in the turtleneck yeah. and the mom jeans
right.
pacing back and forth.
Yeah.
So to have that be the our way in made a lot of sense to me. Mm-hmm. There's two big hurdles this thing had to clear. The first is when you tell me somebody's a genius, they're exceptional, what they do is what somebody else doesn't do, that's not enough. because I don't care who they are. If you're going to prove genius to me, you have to say, here's what they do. That's more important. And in that case, and in many cases of genius movies like this, what they do turns out to be either too complicated or too abstract to really convey cinematically. The other thing is the notion that giant D-bag is giant D-bag, colon, remains giant D-bag, may be true, but it's not a story.
Yeah.
And so I did feel that Sorkin and Boyle kind of imposed a what turns out to be a surprisingly, and in my case disappointingly, conventional narrative structure on this thing. Mm-hmm. It really kicks in pretty hard at the end,
yeah.
focusing on his relationship with his daughter.
Yeah.
But that was my initial takeaway.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that you touch on one of my main frustrations with this movie, which is watching it, you're kind of seeing in many ways the case for the prosecution being laid out over the course of this movie. This guy mistreats his coworkers, he's incredibly arrogant and demanding and mercurial and just frustrating. His ideas are not always, you know, are not always the best ideas. And you go through all that and you see he is a very reluctant father figure and just all this really crummy behavior. And then at the end of the movie, it's like, the defense rests.
Yeah.
So you feel like this movie isn't on his side until it makes these kind of half-hearted efforts to redeem him in ways I found very unconvincing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What What'd you think, Gene?
I totally agree. It seemed like the movie was trying to not be hagiography, which is the thing that biopics always do.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Even in that belated effort to redeem him, he comes across as really jerkish and manipulative.
Yeah.
So the first hour and 45 minutes of the movie, it's pretty, like, relentless in showing him as being a terrible father. We're sort of joking about this after the movie a little bit, but one of the tick that Sorkin is always criticized for is having his great man character talking to women as if they're children. And in this movie, that was literalized because he's talking to his, you know, his 4 or 5 year old daughter as if she's a child because she's a child. But he's very condescending to her. And he comes across as sort of a monster in the way he treats his daughter. There's a whole scene about the way she's under the impression that one of the early machines is named after her. It's called the Lisa. And he sort of very pointedly tries to disabuse her of that notion. Like, that's just a coincidence.
At age 5.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, because that's important at that age. One of the things that I think is interesting about this movie is that it has so much of what makes Sorkin stuff both great and sometimes frustrating. Because I am a person who has a very kind of intimate connection as far as culture with Sorkin stuff, right? He has done some of my absolute favorite things, not just things I think are brilliant, but my favorite things, the things that I watch a million times, not just Sports Night, which I've talked about on this show 11 billion times and still is arguably my favorite contemporary show on television, but also The American President, which I have watched 11 billion times and can quote much of, and A Few Good Men, which I have watched 11 billion times and can quote much of. At the same time, I was not a fan of The Newsroom or Studio 60. Some other stuff I've been a little more mixed on. I really loved the screenplay of The Social Network. I thought that was a very good screenplay. And I think a lot of the joy of this movie is in the wonderful way that he writes conversation between people. If you like that stuff, if you like the way that he, his wonderful ear for dialogue, I think there's a lot of that in here for people. The problem is, if you've seen a ton of his stuff, he is such a stylist in this great way. But I think once it imprints on you, like for a lot of people, it imprinted on them on The West Wing. It imprinted on me on Sports Night. So everything to me sounds like Sports Night, but not as good. And and that's just, it has nothing to do with it actually not being as good. But the rhythms of those conversations, you're accustomed to them. You kind of know how they sound. And he is a legendary borrower from himself, not just of rhythms, but of specific lines. There is a line in this movie where one character says to another, "If I weren't here, you would be the easiest A at such and such college," meaning you'd be a college professor instead of a hotshot. There is an almost identical line in The American President. "Why are you always a step behind me? Because if I weren't, you'd be the most popular history professor at the University of Wisconsin." It's the same line. And he does this all the time, which is not a flaw necessarily, except that if you know all his stuff really well, you constantly are hearing those little things and it yanks you out of the movie a little bit. Mm-hmm. It also has one of his, as Gene sort of mentioned, the great man story is, the great man story is not necessarily the fascination of his entire career, but it's been the fascination of his recent career. The Newsroom is like this. And it was funny to see Jeff Daniels in this movie because Jeff Danielsing around. He has had this fascination, not just with the idea of the great man, but the great man who no one will listen to, and how hard it is to be the great man who's right about everything and no one will listen to you. That's what The Newsroom is, which I consider kind of his most, to me, insufferable piece for exactly that reason. Mm-hmm. What I like about this movie, and the reason why I liked a lot of what he's doing in this movie, is that this movie is many things. It is not moralistic. When I first heard that he was doing a Steve Jobs thing, I was like, oh my God, this is going to be him talking about the internet, which is not something anyone wants, right? It's not something anyone wants who doesn't like this, the moralistic great man story. This really isn't that. This is really not about the internet. It is mostly about, well, I don't, that's part of the, I don't really know what it's about. And that's part, maybe part of the problem.
Well, yeah, it's not moralistic, but there is a moral center. And that is Kate Winslet's character playing Joanna Hoffman.
There's always a lady there to be the moral center.
Exactly. And that's what I'm curious about, because she does call him on his stuff, but she, like this movie, is complicit in the veneration of Steve Jobs.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
She turns on a dime from calling him out to saying, now go get there and make a dent in the world.
But it was interesting to me to read that she has a much smaller role in the Isaacson book.
Right.
That it's been played up, because this is the same character that exists in the newsroom. It's the same character to some degree that exists for a couple of different men in West Wing. It is a very common character of his, is the woman who is there to kind of be your emotional babysitter.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And here is my crackpot theory. Based on that, this is as close as we're ever going to get to the Aaron Sorkin biopic. Here is a guy who walks around constantly being told that he's condescending. Mm-hmm. Now, I have to imagine those scenes were pretty easy to write. I have to imagine it's like he's taking dictation from God, because it's just flowing through him.
Yeah.
It does feel like this character is so similar to other Sorkin characters that it might be similar to Sorkin.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely has that Sorkin-y problem of drastically overvaluing the significance of a good stern lecture,
mm-hmm.
which when you have a lot of scenes in which people are lecturing each other, that is naturally going to snap, crackle, and pop in his hands. I will say, we haven't yet gotten to my favorite character in this movie, and the character in this movie that for me salvages it completely and makes it ultimately something I recommend, and that is Seth Rogen as Steve Wozniak, who is really allowed to be, I think, actually the true moral center of the movie. He is certainly the person who is kind of coming in there, and it's, on one hand, he's the voice of, like, why you gotta be such a jerk all the time? Why do you gotta be like this? Why don't you share credit? Ultimately, he's providing a crucial argument in this film about whether brilliance and success are the product of one kind of auteur or the result of collaboration. And and Jobs is the person who is very much, everything revolves around him. He is the sun around which everything orbits. And then you have Wozniak over here just basically, like, share the credit. Be good to the people who have made this possible. And there's this very, very crucial exchange near the end of the movie that I wish they had just ended the movie cold there, where he's basically just saying, like, you can be as gifted as you want, but you also can be a nice person. They're not mutually exclusive.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And to me, if that had just been kind of the lesson of the movie, I would have felt a little bit better than if they had tried to provide this redemption at the end.
Yeah.
Rogan was great, mainly because he was basically saying the things I think everyone in the audience was probably thinking, like, you are a terrible human being. Why must you be terrible?
Yeah.
But Kate Winslet, as she is wont to do, like, she is amazing. I mean, it was hard to tell that it was Kate Winslet, even though she's, like, one of the most recognizable women in Hollywood. Yeah. She's, like, and layered under these terrible wigs and these horrible 80s, like, shoulder paddy.
Yeah, yeah.
This purple.
Fashion feels right.
It was sort of like asymmetrical scarf thing happening. Yeah. It was so bizarre what was happening there. She was fantastic. Fassbender is always, like, I think he sort of has, he's a fastball guy. Like, he's always, he has, like, one register, which is, like, super intense.
Yeah, I think there's some truth to that.
Yeah, like, he doesn't sort of.
I'm not sure he's a great modulator.
Yeah, he doesn't really modulate.
He doesn't really need it in this movie.
No, he doesn't,
necessarily.
Right. I mean,
the other performance we haven't talked about that I like a lot is Michael Stuhlbarg, who plays a guy named Andy Hertzfeld, who I had never heard of, who has a really interesting role in this movie, and in particular one late scene in that third segment in which he, for me, is the most emotionally complex person in the movie. He's the person who I felt the most like he was a genuine creation who could rise up out of this movie and exist as a person.
Mm-hmm.
And a person who would have a whole life and a whole set of complex thoughts about what has been happening. And I like that performance a whole lot. And I think it's one that can a little bit slip by. He's kind of there, I think, to represent what it was like to work with this guy.
Well, and he's not as big name an actor, so you don't have that separate, you don't have to go through the process of separating the character from the famous person.
And I will tell you, he is one of two people in this movie, the character is one of two people in this movie named Andy, and the way they talk about there being two people named Andy is the essence of Sorkinian dialogue. Just if you love it, it's like having your back scratched. You hear the way that they play with this, the way that he, it's like watching somebody chew on a toothpick, mm-hmm. and they just kind of like, they got it, and then they move it around a little bit, and they're just kind of like, dun, dun, dun. Or maybe more like watching somebody tie a cherry stem in a knot with his tongue. Mm-hmm. It's like he's so good at those dumb, and I say dumb just because they're silly, these little tiny conversations about these meaningless things that kind of, you feel it building. And I remember the moment when I realized, like, oh, it's a thing. He's going to do a thing. Because I love those little, it's the same thing as in Sports Night when they start talking about the copyright on Happy Birthday. He says, oh, it was written by Mildred and Patty Hill. And Robert Guillaume says, it took two people to write that song. It's these little kind of, you know, these little things that get thrown in, and that's one of them.
Well, I think it's really telling that we have been talking about this movie as an Aaron Sorkin movie mm-hmm. rather than a Danny Boyle movie.
I think it's a writer's movie.
And I do think, yes, it's a writer's movie, but think about how rare that is and how few screenwriters have their work treated
right.
as the work of them rather than a work of a very, very heavily decorated director who
right.
has made major, major motion pictures. Mm-hmm. We have not talked about Danny Boyle once.
But there are also some shots that are very, when you're working in these limited spaces, there are a couple of shots, particularly of the crowd in the first third. And there's a shot, you'll know it when you see it, there's a shot of Jeff Daniels in a long hallway with mm-hmm. a bunch of chairs. That is, I think, a really nicely composed shot. And there's also some very nice, in that scene between Jeff Daniels and Michael Fassbender, there's some structural stuff going on with jumping, the way they cross-cut one sequence and a flashback
right.
sequence as they're trying to kind of sort out this bit of yeah. history. And I think that was interesting, too. Yeah.
Well, one final facile observation that has to do with structure, but it has to do with bone structure. this is when I realized that Michael Fassbender has such a generically handsome face uh-huh. that if you slap a different wig on this guy, he looks completely different.
Yeah.
Specifically, first third of the film, he looks like Wings-era Steven Weber. Last third of the film, he looks like contemporary Bob Saget.
Yep.
You will not be able to not see it.
I wrote down he resembles a cross between Steve Inskeep, Morning Edition host, and Bob Saget.
There you go.
You know, it's funny because I do think, as much as you're calling that a facile observation, I do think it's interesting. Jobs is the same way. Mm-hmm. If you look at pictures of Jobs, yeah. I think they did a good job of capturing the fact that he, in his youth, was sort of a long hair dude. And then as he got older, went through kind of like a besuited phase.
Mm-hmm.
And then really only in that last kind of phase of his life as the guy who was doing the iPod and the iPad and the iPhone, moved into that black turtleneck look that became so, so very iconic, which people now think of as the way he always looked,
mm-hmm. right.
which it wasn't at all. For one thing, that was his look when he became bald,
yep.
among other
right.
things, as
right.
he became bald. Mm-hmm. I think it's interesting because I think I agree with you that Fassbender's kind of all over the place in how he looks, but so was Steve Jobs.
I guess my last point about this movie, or my last thought about this movie, is I wonder how much this movie, like a lot of the Oscar movies from last year, is going to get dinged for taking liberties with the facts.
It will. Mm-hmm.
And taking liberties with the stories. And I'm already seeing that happening to a point. There was a fairly blistering op-ed from Jonas Era in the New York Times who had interviewed Jobs and was basically saying, it's not getting this at all. But there's also, I mean, any movie in which you compress what are obviously years worth of different exchanges into the several minutes before he's giving these presentations. You have his daughter happens to be at all of these things mm-hmm. when apparently she never was.
Yeah.
A lot of the relationship with the daughter is apparently quite heavily modified
changed, yeah.
to suit this. How much that is going to bother people, as we've discussed before, it seems like it bothers people more the closer we are to the present day. The more license you take, the closer we are to the present day, the more it hacks people off. The way that discussions of LBJ got
right.
really, really got people's dander up about Selma
yeah.
compared to like The Imitation Game, which turns a military hero mm-hmm. into a villain for mm-hmm. the sake of
yeah.
Yeah.
Of drama. I'm curious to see how much that hurts this movie yeah. as it, you know, heads into awards season.
I think Sorkin's been very open in the fact that in writing the screenplay, he talked to a lot of people, right? He talked to as many mm-hmm. of these people as he could, and he said he talked to most of them. I mean, he said since The Social Network, like, it's not supposed to literally be exactly what happened.
Yeah.
It's supposed to be a kind of, it's the same thing he said about Facebook and about writing about Mark Zuckerberg. It's it's supposed to be a kind of impressionistic version of what happened. Maybe it's what happened. Maybe it's not quite what happened. Anyway, I will be interested to see how people feel about it once they've seen it. It had a very big per screen average at a very small opening weekend. Just last weekend as we tape this, it will be opening more widely in the next week or two. So I'll be interested to hear what y'all think. Come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or on Twitter at NPRPCHH and tell us what you think about Steve Jobs. When we come back, this is one movie about a mogul, but heaven knows there have been plenty of movies about moguls and titans of industry and other business folk. And we're going to talk about those when we come back.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from the Cinemax original series The Nick, from Steven Soderbergh and starring Clive Owen as the brilliant but flawed surgeon Dr. John W. Thackeray. The new season of The Nick, set in 1901, finds the staff of the Knickerbocker Hospital in turmoil as they prepare for the hospital to be shuttered in favor of a new building uptown. In this world of corruption, invention, and progress, everyone is searching for the new path that will help him or her survive. The Nick airs Fridays at 10 p.m., 9 central, exclusively on Cinemax.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Before the break, we were talking about Steve Jobs, the new movie about the Apple co-founder. But, you know, we were thinking about the fact that there have been a lot of movies about moguls and captains. I mean, there have been other movies even about Steve Jobs, right? The famous Ashton Kutcher movie that I can't claim to have actually seen, but it exists. And also I discovered today Pirates of Silicon Valley, which was a TNT TV movie starring Noah Wiley as Steve Jobs and Anthony Michael Hall as Bill Gates, which I had totally forgot happened. But I rented it today on Google Play because I'm a pro.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Or a masochist. Saying.
Those $3.
I brought my DVD copy of Citizen Kane to work and didn't watch it.
Nice. Perfect. Perfect. Appreciate that. Appreciate that preparation-wise. I mean, Sorkin himself, right? We talked about The Social Network, but he also did Moneyball, which is a great man slash mogul movie, sort of. There are ones that are documentaries, like Roger and Me. There are ones that are all kinds of movies. Steven, bring me in. Talk to me about mogul movies.
Well, I mentioned Citizen Kane. I have, in fact, seen Citizen Kane. I thought I would just refresh myself beyond the inevitable collection of reference points that that have accumulated in my head over the years. But, I mean, Citizen Kane is a really interesting example of trying to get to the heart of a mogul and kind of what makes a sort of megalomaniacal figure tick. And it's interesting how many of these movies, as you start to tick them off, anywhere from Tucker, A Man in His Dream, to even something like Ed Wood, you know, somebody who's these visionaries, anytime you're trying to capture a visionary, they so often are looking for some way to explain it. Mm-hmm. And one of the most important ingredients to the success or failure of a movie like that is how nuanced can they be in explaining why these people turn out the way they are. And in Citizen Kane, you know, explaining why Charles Foster Kane has turned out the way that he has is I'm not even going to spoil it. It's the most spoiled thing this side of a certain Star Wars plot point.
Certainly.
But I'm still going to refrain. But I mean, it ultimately is saying, like, because he didn't have a childhood.
That's right.
That's why he behaves the way he did.
Which, for a fantastic film, has a really sentimental heart.
Yeah. And ultimately, you cut that. I mean, that is obviously, it is a great film. It hasn't always aged perfectly, in part because of how endlessly referenced it is. Mm-hmm. It was very influential. But at the time, that was, I think, a groundbreaking take. Even in a movie like Steve Jobs, Steve Jobs wanders off into digressions about, like, the fact that he was adopted and then given up for adoption again, and how that clearly shaped the way he pursues perfection.
I think the presentation of that was a little blunt.
Very blunt, and I thought it was one of the weakest things in the movie.
Yeah.
But it's very interesting when you look at mogul movies, how often they take the time to try to find some fairly blunt force explanation for why the mogul is a certain way, in part to humanize analyze, in part to explain, in part to presumably kind of comfort the viewer that like that success isn't all it's cracked up to be. Mm-hmm. That in order to be massively successful, you have to have this hole in your heart.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
I would say that the parent thing, the childhood thing goes both ways too. I mean, in Steve Jobs, obviously, like he's obviously has this gaping void where his biological parents are supposed to be. I think that's the way the movie wants you to orient yourself to him. But even like a movie like There Will Be Blood, right? Where Daniel Day-Lewis's character is a terrible father, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that thing goes both ways. Like, we don't know much about his sort of origin mm-hmm. story, but we're supposed to get this idea that like whatever it is, it makes him incapable of sort of loving people who are close to him.
Right.
And I think that's sort of boring, actually. Mm-hmm. Like, it's always like these people are immoral. Like, I mean, and the thing that motivates them is sort of just a fundamental brokenness. But I don't think it's just like it's ever like, oh, I gotta make things right because my father was not around or my mother wasn't around or I'm a terrible father to
some
my
people,
own children.
Yeah, some people are just very driven people.
Sure.
You
yeah,
know? And some people, that's what they're into.
Yeah.
You know?
I wish movies like this were more willing to go down the path of simply blaming, you know, moral corrosion and greed
right.
and compromised
yeah,
values. Simple selfishness.
Sure.
It's one of the nice things about Breaking Bad
mm-hmm.
is you see it as a process
right.
instead of some pat explanation.
Sure.
Well, let's tap dance aside here for a second over to fiction, because it seems to me that American writers have looked at success in business with great suspicion.
Right.
And they've done it for a long time.
Right.
Now, they didn't start out like that. If you go back to the late part of the 1800s, the Horatio Alger story, Rags
mm-hmm.
to Riches,
mm-hmm.
demanded that there be a young white boy who was virtuous, who worked hard. That is, to me, the key, and also had tenacity and stuck with it.
Yeah.
In the 20s and 30s, we start to see a more cynical take on success in business. Babbitt is a satire. Gatsby is no hero. And we start to see things like Citizen Kane.
In modern times.
In modern times, exactly. And it seems to me, okay, I get this now. That is the release valve on the American dream. We think the American dream is too hokey, too hopeful,
mm-hmm.
and so we need this cynicism. But then at that same time, all those films and books were happening. What did people flock to the cinema to see? Topper, The Philadelphia Story,
mm-hmm.
Private Lives, these concoctions that had mm-hmm. that idealized the, not necessarily moguls, but
wealthy.
Life among the upper crust.
Right, no, totally.
Which dealt with the trappings of wealth and power, but not the work required to get it, because in many cases they were inherited.
Right. And I think very often stories about business people and stories about rich people have been different threads of fiction
mm-hmm.
and fictional works. You know, we did a show quite a while ago where we talked about depictions of the wealthy. And one of the things that we talked about was a lot of times the entire purpose of putting a wealthy person in a fictional story is for them to fall, provided that they are not deserving.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you get with like the dukes in Trading Places, for example. But that the purpose of the less wealthy person is to become wealthy if
right.
they are deserving.
Right.
So fiction takes a completely different view. Like it can despise the existing wealthy people,
right.
but it can still suggest that the happy ending for the good people is to become wealthy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's a very weird, so that the villain is usually not wealth. It's how you go about being a rich
yeah.
person. It's like Mr. Potter and It's a Wonderful
exactly.
Life, right?
Right. Greed.
It's fine to be rich. It's fine to have money, but you can't be like that.
And that's where the moralistic component comes in. You know, we are a Puritan society. We
right.
founded on those principles. So the presence of greed with somebody who is very powerful is the thing that marks them as a villain. The presence of laziness, entitlement
right.
also marks them as a villain, as opposed to those kind of comedies where they're just happy.
Right.
Just carefree.
Right. Like Friends.
Exactly.
we went through this fascinating period in the 80s. I mean, for those of you who were alive, in the 80s. They, at this time of very much kind of the Reagan 80s of stocks and the idea that you were going to make all your money in the stock market,
greed is good.
All this stuff, right? Well, right, because Wall Street is 1987,
mm-hmm.
Working Girl is 1988.
Mm-hmm.
And Wall Street is a movie about the operations of Wall Street as a fundamentally evil, terrible thing full of monsters, and it's a pit of vipers and all this stuff. In 1988, in Working Girl, it is an aspirational way to work your way up and to achieve success. And there is, I've talked about this a bunch of times, but the final shots of Working Girl, where Melanie Griffith turns out to be in this tiny little office, which on the one hand is like, it's her triumph, but then they sort of pull out and you see, I believe Roger Ebert wrote about this in his review of this movie, which is where I think I originally saw this discussed, but you pull out and kind of see she's part of this massive, faceless landscape of New York. And I think that it's interesting to see that kind of success in business could be simultaneously this thing that we feared and this thing that we also saw as maybe an element of the American dream, right? Mm-hmm. And one of the things I think is so interesting that I mentioned when we were throwing around this topic that I wanted to talk about is, do we really have the same visions of moguls in popular culture outside of white dudes?
Well, what do you mean? Let's tease this out.
Because like we are, when we talk about like movies about moguls, mm-hmm. right? Whether you're talking about Moneyball, The Social Network, Roger and Me, Trading Places, Working Girl, all these ones that I have written down. By the way, there's a list of mogul movies at MarketWatch and one at Forbes, both of which are fun lists to look at. Mm-hmm. You do see a lot of white dudes, mm-hmm. right? But we certainly have cultural visions of, for example, people of color who are moguls.
Sure.
Right? Mm-hmm. You have them on like Empire.
But it's
always entertainment industry.
Sure,
right?
Absolutely. Right.
As opposed to financial industry.
Well, I mean, because real life.
I'm not necessarily saying it's not real life, but it's interesting to see how like in pop culture, I'm trying to think of like a vision of like a wealthy black banker.
Sure.
Like mm-hmm. you have so many of mm-hmm. these like besuited business dudes, mm-hmm. as we said.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a pretty accurate reflection of the larger world, right?
Right.
I mean, there aren't many. There are obviously super wealthy black folks out there, but very few of them. I mean, a lot of them are sort of adjacent to entertainment, right? You had Oprah, you got Bob Johnson, you got a couple of people like that, but they're all like media moguls, right?
And there are some, I'm sure.
Sure, there are tons.
Herman Cain.
right.
A mega pastor, Creflo Dollar.
Creflo Dollar. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I mean, like, they're all sort of, well, Herman Cain. Well, I mean, there's not people who've sort of risen up the ranks of finance necessarily.
Right.
And there are obviously big historical reasons for why that is. Empire, I mean, some of the most obvious examples in real life popular culture, I mean, are moguls, right? I mean, Jay-Z is a mogul. Puffy Combs is a mogul.
Dre.
That's a very familiar. I mean, Barry Gordy. I mean, this is a very old sort of archetype, right?
This
like uber wealthy black patriarch. And so I think that's just sort of people are playing with something, a very familiar idea.
The only woman who I found kind of in the realm of this kind of movie, and it was actually, I couldn't think of any, and this Market Watch list that I mentioned mm-hmm. included The Devil Wears Prada.
Which was good for you, Thompson. Thank you.
Which I think is a fair inclusion, even though she is an editor, but not necessarily an owner. Mm-hmm. She's not necessarily the business.
But she's still a gatekeeper.
She mm-hmm. is. She's the gatekeeper. She's the person everyone works for, and she's the person everyone fears. And mm-hmm. and I think that she's at least the person who has the massive quantity of power, mm-hmm. even if it's not that she owns anything.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because you do find out during the course of that movie, they can fire her at any time. And mm-hmm. that's the fundamental of being a mogul, mm-hmm. is like they can, it's like your, your stuff. It's your
Where do you place the oeuvre of one Miss Jackie Collins? Doesn't Lucky own stuff? Isn't she sort of ahead of something?
Yes, I think that's right. I'm glad that you mentioned that, because I think you are right, that I think Jackie Collins was a writer of female moguls. And I'm actually, Lucky Santangelo. But, Lucky Santangelo.
Wanted to call her Lucky Pierre. I was pretty sure it wasn't that.
No, Lucky Santangelo is in a whole series of books, including Lucky, which I read when I was probably too young.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it was interesting because Jackie Collins died recently, and her sister, the lovely Joan Collins, had written a remembrance of her in which she said she thinks that Lucky was sort of Jackie Collins' own kind of projection of herself more than anybody else. Well, she wrote tons and tons and tons of books. She wrote Hollywood Wives and Hollywood Husbands and all this other stuff. But she did write Lucky into this series. And I do think you're right that that was an example of a series of stories about like a straight up mogul. And frankly, soaps have had them too.
That's what I was going to too.
Very often cosmetics companies.
I was going to say, yeah.
or fashion.
Sure.
Any number of the women lines. Who took over Victor Newman's empire in Young and the Restless.
Yeah, but I think there are, I think there are examples. But I think it's interesting because the ones that you're talking about come out of kind of women's fiction and women and television oriented to women as opposed to kind of general interest stuff.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think we do have a very weird cultural relationship with moguls because I think Steve Jobs is exactly like this, right? People have such reverence for him, especially Apple people. But one of the things I liked about the movie is it is willing to question that narrative by kind of having Wozniak in particular say,
what do you do?
You don't code. Yeah. You don't. You can't build anything. You need all these other people actually to execute your ideas, which is true of all ideas people. And yet the movie is constantly making the argument that he was an amazing ideas person.
Sure. Right.
Right.
And that's one of the things, like I said, that salvaged that movie. That scene is so important and so rare in like film depictions, I think, in particular of moguls. Because when you think about like how do filmmakers view making films, it's a film by so-and-so.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Like,
it's a great point.
Directors are very likely to subscribe to the auteur theory that every film is the product of one person's amazing vision.
Sure.
When in fact, a film is a collaboration among dozens upon dozens upon dozens
right.
of people.
Mm-hmm.
But you see that so rarely, not only in films, but in the media, who are always so likely to pick out one person in a
right.
successful project and just assume that every good idea associated with that project is attached to that one
well,
person.
Or that the ideas in and of themselves would be of much value, right? If you didn't have people who knew how to take them and make them into an actual thing, because otherwise you have a person who's like, I'm the idea guy. Like every time I hear somebody be like, people don't always say this in so many words, but every time you hear like, I'm the idea guy, it's like, nah, yeah. that's great.
I'm not
but,
so much with the doing of
but
things.
But part of what you have to be able to do is translate that. And one of the things I like about the movie is I think the movie does provoke you to think about whether you can, on the one hand, think the guy's a crazy genius when it comes to brilliant ideas about understanding the future, and yet, first of all, understand that he's fallible, right? As not all of these are hugely successful product launches.
Yep.
And also understand that he is nobody without all these people who he sort of waves. I mean, he knows how to motivate. That's kind of the movie's argument. He knows how to motivate people and get good work out of them.
A lot of that's just bullying.
Yeah.
Well, right. But how do you do your bullying, right? And that's his argument. That's his argument to the guy I mentioned, Andy Hertzfeld, at the end of the movie. He's like, did you get done what I told you to get done?
Yeah.
Well, then I'm happy. And I have no regrets about how I treated you. And it's like, well, yeah. I don't know. Again, I'll be interested to hear what folks have to say about mogul movies and rich business person movies. And again, find us on Facebook. It's facebook.com/PCHH. We're on Twitter at NPRPCHH. When we come back, it's time for our favorite segment of this and every week. What is making us happy this week? Do not go away.
This episode of Pop Culture Happy Hour and the following message are made possible by NatureBox.com on a mission to make smart, delicious snacking easy. From Big Island pineapple to jalapeno white cheddar popcorn to pistachio power clusters, NatureBox delivers over 100 bold, satisfying choices right to your door. And all NatureBox snacks are made with high-quality ingredients and zero artificial nonsense. At work or at home, NatureBox gives you a range of ways to indulge your snacking needs. Visit naturebox.com and get your first box now.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It is time for our favorite segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week, buddy?
First up, a little bit of house cleaning. When we predicted the summer movies, we each went around the table and predicted what movie we thought would be a boondoggle. And while I by no means revel in the failure of others, my pick was Pan, which ended up getting pushed to October and made back 10% of its budget in its opening weekend.
It cost not great.
Cost $150 million, made $15 million. Has been, I've seen descriptions floating around of like the worst movie I've ever seen. It looked horrible. I will confess that I have not seen it. maybe it's great. But I did predict that that movie would be a boondoggle. Maybe that wasn't a swing for the fences kind of prediction, but it came true. So I'm celebrating more my rightness than I am the actual failure of the project, which contains many people whose work I enjoy in other areas. Saw the first trailer for an upcoming Netflix series coming November 13th called With Bob and David, which is a sort of reboot of Mr. Show, which they cannot call Mr. Show because it is not HBO, which presumably owns the rights to Mr. Show. They're calling it With Bob and David. It is Bob Odenkirk and David Cross, and many of the people who made that original HBO sketch comedy series is so etched into my humor sensibility and so beloved. I don't know if this show is going to be great. The trailer seemed very uneven. I am sure it is not quite as disciplined as the original series, but, you know, we're just in an age when you can just reboot Wet Hot American Summer. Yep. What the hell? So the fact that they're serving me so directly delights me. Finally, I grabbed off of the freebie shelves here at NPR a book called Tacopedia, which is a wonderful encyclopedia of tacos full of recipes, and I cannot wait to use it as a means of acquiring and consuming an enormous quantity of tacos.
You'll notice he didn't say making a lot of tacos. I think someone else is going to be doing that. Thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week, sir?
Well, I was made very happy to be able to go on Morning Edition this week with our pal Barry Hardiman and discuss the National Book Award finalists. No, we didn't have a lot of time.
But people have heard that in their feed this week. We got that on the podcast feed.
And, you know, I read 16 books this weekend, preparation for this, because I had read four of them already. And I didn't get to talk about them all. So now I'm going to talk about some of them that I didn't get to.
Exactly.
First up, this will be a quick whistle. Stop tour of four books I didn't get to mention. Lauren Groff's Fates and Furies is being called by many people the literary Gone Girl, which I think is A, condescending as hell to Gone Girl, and B, I mean, yes, it shares some structural components, and I will say, of course, that while Gone Girl has a really pulpy feeling to it, you know, it's satisfyingly pulpy, and it kind of rubs up against the genre of crime and mystery, the appeal of Fates and Furies, which is really about a marriage and this fallacy of intimacy, this idea that we get to know somebody else so thoroughly, doesn't go in that same pulpy way, but its pleasures are just as real. They're a little bit more thoughtful. They're more abstract, but it's a great book. Two books in nonfiction, Sally Mann's Hold Still. Sally Mann, of course, the excellent photographer. Turns out she's a great writer, which I don't think is fair.
Yeah, agreed.
But this book is, you know, about her background, her family, and her work. Both. And we see interspersed throughout the pages her photographs, and she talks about how they were made. So, A, she has the advantage of being born into a family that is basically a Faulkner novel. That's fascinating. And then, B, we get not just her explicating herself, but explicating her philosophy of work, her aesthetic, her approach, her influences. It is a great book. A second book in nonfiction called The Soul of an Octopus by Cy Montgomery is exactly what it purports to be. It's about consciousness in the octopus, emotions in the octopus. It is a treatise on this, a personal exploration. Now, my undergrad is in marine biology. I could hear my very rigorous old professors who hated anything that even resembled anthropomorphizing kind of gritting their teeth at this book as I turned every page, but she sells it. She believes deeply, and it's an interesting book. Finally, a book in young people's literature that I didn't get a chance to talk about called Bone Gap by Laura Ruby is about a small town in the Midwest where a very mysterious kidnapping happens, and the book starts at that moment. And what I love about this book is that she, with great control, lets magic leach into the narrative in such a way that you don't notice it happening until you're midway through the book and you've got these two worlds existing side by side. It's so controlled, hits none of the fantasy tropes, none of the cliches, so that's Bone Gap. So those are, I could talk some more, but those are a lot of the books I didn't get to talk about.
Wonderful. Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon. I feel so literary. Gene Demby, what is making you happy this week?
So Glenn shouted out the Hamilton cast soundtrack last week. I've been annoying Linda, I'm sure, and everyone on Twitter.
Not annoying me
with
a
my
bit.
Squeeing over that. I want to just co-sign that, furiously co-sign that.
So that's three of us so far in the show.
It's so ridiculous. I'm not a musical person. I was like in my apartment singing Wait For It with my fist in the air, like sweat on my brow. Like, is this how musical people feel all the time? It seems so exhausting. I don't know how y'all do it. I wanted to shout out two things that are on the opposite ends of the emotional spectrum. Sicario, which is the new movie with Emily Blunt, Benicio Del Toro, and Josh Brolin, is really, really, really good and like the bleakest thing you will ever see. It's one of those movies like, I love this movie, I will never see it again. I would never watch it again. But it was incredibly intense and has a lot of smart things to say. And it does stuff like structurally that are sort of discomfiting. Does a bunch of really interesting stuff with Emily Blunt's character. She's sort of centered as the audience surrogate, and then she isn't. And they sort of make you complicit in her gradual sidelining. If we were talking earlier about women as moral centers, and they sort of make her this, and as the movie becomes more and more sort of morally ambivalent, she becomes more sidelined as the movie goes on. You should see it. It is the kind of movie that will keep you up all night. The other one is Miranda July's Rihanna profile in the Times T Magazine. It is the best case scenario for a celebrity profile, which are usually terrible, terrible endeavors. But she sort of just opened, like, big-heartedly, like, I'm a Rihanna fan. I'm not going to camouflage this. I mean, at one point, she's, like, explaining to her husband and her child, like, you guys don't understand how big a deal this is that I'm going to interview Rihanna. She's talking to all these people, like, what should I ask Rihanna? Everyone was like, why is Rihanna so amazing? And so, and it's just like, that's a great question. And it's just like a sort of a big love letter to Rihanna, who is an artist who I don't particularly care for all the time, but I sort of marvel like a lot of people at the phenomenon of Rihanna love. That is a real thing that exists in the pop culture
totally
universe. So that's it. Those are the two things that make me happy.
Wonderful. Yeah. Very, very good. Okay, I got three things making me happy this week.
Okay.
How happy can one girl get? First of all, I'm still loving a playlist that I made on Spotify a month or two ago called Knee on the Door. If you look for it, it's called Knee on the Door. It is mostly radio pop of my youth and early adulthood. It has a lovely stretch in the middle where there's some nerd glasses pop of the 80s and 90s. There's some XTC and Elvis Costello and Marshall Crenshaw kind of all together, which is basically the source code to my heart. So treat it carefully. Number two, Gene's friends at Another Round had Hillary Clinton on this week.
Oh,
go figure. And it's a really, really interesting interview. And I think anybody who covers news, it's not that you have to look at this and say this is how everything should be done, but it's really worth listening to and thinking about the way they did that interview and the way what everybody in that interview is trying to accomplish. And it says a lot about where news is and where audio is and where podcasts are. And it's just, even if it weren't a really good interview, which it is, it's an interesting artifact. And the fact that it exists
Absolutely.
Is interesting. And then finally, you'll all be happy to know, it's Hallmark holiday movie season. And therefore, I got to watch this weekend a movie called Harvest Moon, which involves a woman who discovers that her parents, who were rich people of some sort, have lost a bunch of their money. But she happens to own a pumpkin farm, just as you do.
As one does.
Like, they just kind of own it as a side thing. Uh-huh. For some reason, they picked up a pumpkin farm. Who doesn't, right? You own all kinds of stuff. She owns a pumpkin farm. So she goes out there and is immediately hit with a bale of hay by a hot dude working near a pickup truck. Who, again, hits her with a bale of hay and actually knocks her rich lady heel-wearing behind into a mud puddle.
What are the chances?
Because that's how it goes.
Yep.
And then eventually she figures out that she can use her pumpkins to make skincare products and save the pumpkin farm.
That is. Hallmark bingo.
Man. It is.
I was going to say, if there were some sort of cute animal...
I am telling you, it is so satisfying, and soon it will be Christmas movies. Before you know it, it will be Christmas movies. This is my favorite. This is my favorite quarter of the year. Is the part where I get to watch these, and so I'm always very gratified, and it makes me so pleased and so excited because I cannot get enough movies where the emotional center happens 9 minutes in when a small child says, "My mommy's in heaven."
Oh, man.
And that is what is making me happy this week. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Steven at I Dislike Steven. You can follow Glenn at GH Weldon and Gene at GD215. That's GEEDEE215. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy, and our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, KATZIF. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are tapping your foot to right now. So thanks to all of you for being here.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you right back here next week.
Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Car advice, tips, troubleshooting, and occasional answers to car questions in between the laughter. That's the Car Talk Podcast with Click and Clack, the Tappet Brothers. Laugh along anytime to the Car Talk Podcast. Find Car Talk now at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.